Welcome to the Combat Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Peacock. My guest today is Dr. Robert Rosenthal, an eminent psychologist and researcher and distinguished professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. He's best known for his work in teacher expectancy effects, known more commonly as the Pygmalion effect. In this episode, Professor Rosenthal explains how teacher expectations on their students affect how well those students perform. We also explore how scientific research works and how anyone, even you, could design, execute, and publish a scientific paper. This episode might be a gut punch to many instructors, and if it isn't, it probably ought to be. So if your interest is piqued, hit the subscribe button on your podcatcher now. I want to talk to you about the Pygmalion effect, because that's something that is... It's something I think a lot about. I've taught kids for a long time in martial arts and in adults as well. And there's all kinds that come through there. And there's kind of I guess you could say there's a culture of, we have these ideas of what's the mark of a student who's going to be good when they come in, like who's going to go places, and who you should give your attention to, and then who's probably going to be slower. And those are the people that, you know, you'll give help to and everything, but they're probably not going to, you know, they're not going to really go anywhere. You're not going to be coaching them at a national event or anything like that. So, for any of my, anyone that'll be listening in on this later, could you kind of give your best summary of what the Pygmalion effect is?
Sure. Let me give you a very brief history to provide a context. It all started back in 1956 at the University of California, Los Angeles, when I was working on my PhD doctoral dissertation. Mm-hmm. And I did an experiment in clinical psychology, and I did a statistical analysis that was an outgrowth of my being just very compulsive about data. Mm-hmm. And it was an analysis I didn't need to do. But what it showed me, quite incidentally, that had nothing to do directly with my hypothesis about defense mechanisms and stuff like that. But what it suggested to me was that I might have unintentionally affected the results of my research by virtue of the expectations that I was holding for my research subjects, my research participants. And that was such a scary moment for me, but also kind of an eye-opening moment. And not long after that, I got my first teaching job after I got my PhD, with pretty fouled-up results, by the way, for my doctoral dissertation, because of this mistake, you know, or artifact that I had discovered when I was analyzing my data. Oh. But when I got to the University of North Dakota in 1957. That was my first job after my UCLA PhD. I right away began doing some experiments on experimenter biasing, we used to call it in those days. And the experimenter bias phenomenon is really experimenter expectancy. And what we did was we gave some experimenters an expectation for a particular type of research result, and we gave other experimenters randomly assigned kind of opposite expectations. And what we found was, in our very first experiment, that if we had led experimenters to expect, say, high photograph ratings of the success of other people, those experimenters tended to get from their research subjects the data that we expected our experimenters to get. And similarly, if the experimenters that we had given a negative expectation that they would receive ratings of more of failure of in photographs of faces, because we had told them, we just arbitrarily labeled them, you know, that way, as people who were going to see failure in other people's faces. Well, then the subjects who were run by these experimenters who were given these negative expectations, they tended to give negative ratings. So that if the experimenters were expecting positive ratings of photographs from their subjects, they tended to get more positive photo ratings. If they expected to get more negative photo ratings, they tended to get more photo ratings. Well, we didn't believe that result for one moment. It was crazy. So we did another experiment, and we got the same result, and we didn't believe that because it was crazy. And then we did a third experiment, and we got the same result. Each time the experiment was a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And so, by golly, we began to believe it. And, I started to publish articles about this phenomenon that originally I referred to as experimenter bias. And later, in a more accurate way, a more specific way, I called it experimenter expectancy effects or experimenter interpersonal expectancy, because it was their expectation for the behavior of a different person, namely the subjects they were instructing, that would lead those subjects to respond in accordance with the expectations of the experiment. So that was the reason for that label. And then in the history of this Pygmalion effect, we had this interesting thing. I wrote a paper. We had done by this time maybe 30 experiments altogether. Yeah. And other people in other parts of the country were beginning to do these experimenter expectancy studies. And we wrote an article, I think it was in a very general science journal, not a psychological journal. I think it was called The American Scientist. And we wrote an article that sort of summarized a whole bunch of these studies. And we ended it, that article, very dramatically. I ended it dramatically, saying something like, if experimenters get the results they've been expected to get, then maybe teachers' expectations function in a similar way. Mm. And teachers will get the behavior and the performance from their students that they have been led to expect. And so this is a dramatic ending to an article. And guess what? We got a letter in the mail. These were days long before email. This was in the 1960s, and I got a letter from a wonderful school principal in the town of South San Francisco. Geographically, it's south of San Francisco. It's a separate town, and her name was Lenore Jacobson. And she said in her letter, she said, "I read your article, and I saw where you, hypothesized that this might work with teachers as well. And I want to tell you, I'm convinced that it does work with teachers. And if you ever want to get down to the science and see if it really works with teachers, have I got a school for you?" Well, I quickly called the National Science Foundation that was funding my research at the time, which at the time was all about experimenter expectation. And the wonderful director of the social psychology section of the National Science Foundation told me, yes, I could use my grant money to travel out to San Francisco. And so I did, and I flew right out there within a few days to talk with Lenore Jacobson, and together we designed this experiment on teacher expectation effects. And so the first thing we did was I developed a new test that would predict academic blooming. We called it something like the Harvard test of inflected acquisition. That was the fancy name we gave it. And we got hundreds and hundreds of test booklets, and that we had printers make up hundreds of copies that had a cover on it, and the cover said, Harvard test of inflected acquisition. What we actually put the covers on was a real test. It was an IQ test. It was Flanagan's test of general ability, which was an IQ test. And our hypothesis was that if teachers expected better intellectual performance from kids, they'd get it. So here's what we did. At the end of a school year, this was maybe 63, 64, I don't remember exactly the year. All the teachers in the school, there were six grades, and there was a fast and a medium and a slow track. Are you familiar with the idea of tracking in schools?
I did an MED back in a few years ago, and I remember tracking a little bit.
So we basically had what you could think of as a 6x3 experimental design, where we had six grade levels, you know, from first through sixth grade. And for each grade level, we had a fast track, a medium track, and a slow track. So we had 6x3, or 18 classrooms with 18 teachers. And at the end of this particular school year, I think it was in the month of May, we administered these profiles of nonverbal sensitivity, that's a test we developed later, but Harvard tests of inflected acquisition. They were really just IQ tests, separate tests for first and second graders, for third and fourth graders, and fifth and sixth graders, because the items had to be harder, you know, for the older children. But these were all standardized IQ tests. And at the end of a school year, all the teachers administered to the kids who were leaving those teachers this test. So that was just a way of getting them all tested. Mm-hmm. Then the summer came and went, and at the beginning of the school year, the school principal, Lenore Jacobson, went to all the teachers and said at a teacher's meeting, "You remember how you tested all the kids in this school for the Harvard test of inflected acquisition that would predict academic blooming? Well, we have the results of those tests, and we thought you'd like to know which of the kids in your new classes," because each of the 18 teachers would now have a new class of kids, starting in the fall term. "We thought you'd like to know which of the kids in your new class were the kids who scored as intellectual bloomers, mm-hmm. which ones were the kids who are going to get real bright in this coming academic year." And so each teacher got between 3 and 6 names of the new children on his or her list. It's mostly her list, because all the instructors, but I think all but 3 were female teachers, but 3 were male teachers. Yeah. And so we gave each teacher the names, and here's the important thing. The way we selected those names was by using what's called a table of random numbers. We chose the names of the children completely at random. So there's no reason to think that the children whose names we gave to those teachers were no different from the kids whose names we didn't give to the teachers, who were the control group, you know? And then we waited, and at the middle of the school year, we readministered the test of inflected acquisition. And then at the end of the school year, we administered it again for the final time. And so we were able to see the change from the pretest to the midterm, and the changes from the pretest also to the end of the year, the academic year. And what we found was that in almost every classroom, the children who were expected to bloom intellectually gained more IQ than did the kids about whom nothing had been said, the children of the control group. I was happy as an ethical matter to find out that all of the children in the school gained more IQ than we would normally have expected just with the elapsed time. And we think that's part of what's called a so-called Hawthorne effect, which is an effect that was found in industrial psychology many years ago, which showed that if you go into any organization and do an experiment, everybody's going to do better. And that is like a placebo effect. You know, it's an attention effect. If you tell them you're doing something special and, you know, it's going to be helpful, they'll do better. Everybody's going to do better. And so that would be the right control group if you were doing any kind of an intervention, and you would have half, or, you know, some of the, it doesn't have to be half and half, but some would be in the control group who were just, you know, the placebo controls or the Hawthorne controls. And the others would be maybe people of a new method of management or in education, the kids' education would be some educational intervention. So this Pygmalion effect was first discovered in this South San Francisco school, and the effects were very strong statistically. And boy, did we get a lot of headache for that. We got letters. We had articles in the technical literature big name educational psychologists wrote scathing reviews.
Oh, wow.
Of the research. They hated the results.
Oh, my.
And I don't to this day know exactly what it is. Oh, part of it was that there was in the field of educational psychology, I think the view of IQ testing was something that IQ tests were something more fixed than I think we think about nowadays. Nowadays, okay. Being, you know, more than 50 years later, quite a bit more than 50 years later, actually, at least 50 years later, where, you know, we now know that lots of things affect performance on IQ tests. But in those days, I think a lot of famous educational psychology researchers didn't like that at all. They wrote scathing reviews. And of course, I rebutted them all. And some of the most sophisticated statistical critiques I rebutted with the help of a young faculty member at Harvard University's statistics department, mm-hmm. named Donald Rubin, who nowadays is regarded as one of the top 10 statisticians in the world.
Wow.
And he and I wrote a lot of articles rebutting a lot of the statistical critiques, because a lot of these were by statisticians. And although I knew something about data analysis, I was certainly not a statistician.
Right.
But a lot of the articles we wrote together, and, you know, with a world-class statistician, I was very secure that we got the numbers right.
Right.
So that's sort of where things left. And then later, just a few years later, there was a PhD dissertation in the Harvard Graduate School of Education by a wonderful young scholar named Steve Rauenbusch, who's now very famous because he's written some famous statistical textbooks.
Hmm.
And his name is Rauenbusch, and his dissertation was a meta-analysis of, I think it was 18 Pygmalion-type studies, all of these just school studies.
Wow.
And Don Rubin and I did a meta-analysis of 345 studies, which included the school studies, but also included a whole lot of other studies. And from your perspective, it also included studies of physical abilities,
like swimming
ability and running ability and ability to do push-ups. And we found that, you know, PE teachers' expectations for push-ups, the students about phys ed instructors who thought their students could do more push-ups, those kids actually did do more push-ups because of the expectation of the teacher, and presumably because that expectation led to an improved teaching style, I would guess. Mm-hmm. So that kind of catches you up to date to where the area really is now.
Yeah.
And do you work mostly directly with people who are learning martial arts, or do you work mostly or partly with people who are teaching martial arts? You work with both, or?
So right now I'm not teaching martial arts. I'd like to get back into it. I used to teach.
I
mostly talk to and speak to people who are teaching.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, you're like a professor of education then. And that's absolutely, yeah.
Well, I self-appointed because nobody else decided they were going to try and help martial artists, you know, teach better, learn how to teach better and read research and apply.
You know, you should not only do that, but you should write an article about it. And if you do write an article about it, and I'm 87 years old, so I can't guarantee it, but if I'm around, I'll read it over for you, you know, and be sure it's all okay.
Wow.
Publication, but it's the kind of thing that could be published, and I'll bet you there's been no research, and of course, and you young folks all know how to use the computer better than I do on how to, you know, look up old literature and stuff, but I bet you could do, you know, Googles or whatever they're called now to find out if there are studies in teaching martial arts, you know, teacher expectation effect, mm-hmm. and you might be the first person to write an article on teacher expectation effects when you're teaching martial arts.
Yeah, I've never heard of any.
Well, there you go. See, time to contribute. Then it doesn't matter what your day job is. You know, if it's a good article, you'll submit it to a good education journal and I'll publish it.
Wow. I mean, that's really generous of you. I mean, I'll have to email you with thoughts on how to design it because I've never designed a study before.
Great. Be glad to work with you on that. Absolutely.
Awesome. So I guess to summarize the Pygmalion effect, it's really that your expectations on students can have a sharp effect on how they actually perform.
Absolutely. You've nailed it. That's exactly the right way to put it too. Yeah, absolutely. And in all kinds of tasks, you know, the earlier studies were about intellectual tasks, but it's been shown in all kinds of tasks. Things, you know, we've looked at things like reaction time experiments. So if you're expecting faster reaction times, you're going to get it, you know, in these experimental psychology labs where they're doing these really intricate timing jobs. So, you know, if you think your students are going to do something a little faster, even though you're dealing in milliseconds, you're going to get a statistically significant effect. And it was a shocking result to me.
Yeah.
This is in the 1976 article I did with Don Rubin, the brilliant statistician, where we found that when you work with things like reaction time, you get some of the most biggest statistical effects of teacher expectation. And that didn't make sense to us at all because you're dealing with microseconds or milliseconds. And how could that possibly lead to a difference? And then finally, it sort of dawned on us that it's because those things are measured so precisely that even small differences, but that are measured precisely, can lead to very highly noticeable magnitude of effects. So that, you know, but this phenomenon has been found, you know, in all kinds of domains.
Yeah.
So I would expect it to show up.
So in terms of its scientific, I don't know what to call it, its gravity or its credibility, it's really solid.
Yeah, both of those terms are good. And yes, it is solid. And because of those meta-analyses, that, you know, because that's how we're doing hundreds of studies now. And then some meta-analytic studies since our, what was it? Let's see, I think it was 1976 or something that Don Rubin and I did 345 studies in a meta-analysis. And then in later articles, I sort of updated with over 500 studies. So I haven't done a recent meta-analysis because I didn't think there's much point after you're over 500 studies. That's about enough,
right?
You know, but the really interesting questions that remain. You know, if you looked, what's the cutting edge research in teacher expectation research? I would say that even though just replicating, you know, the classroom teachers would get performance that way, isn't going to be a big breakthrough. But any research that studies in a very specific way what it is that the teachers do differently towards the children for whom they have more favorable expectations compared to what they do to the others, these are called mediating mechanisms. That's something that we know something about, we have good hypotheses about, but we don't have hundreds of studies there.
Yeah,
you know, we may have a handful of studies that suggest. My reading of half a dozen to a dozen studies is that teachers teach more warmly to the teachers for whom they have more favorable expectations, and the other thing is they teach them more stuff.
Yeah.
So if you think a kid's smart, then you teach them more stuff, and you know that made me. Historically, in my own academic career as a student, it made me think back to a course I had as an undergraduate. It was a course in exceptional children. I think it was an education course, you know, taught in the ed school at UCLA on exceptional children. And one of the topics was retardation. And I remember when we got to the topic of Down syndrome. Have you heard of Down syndrome?
Oh, yes. I've known several people.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it used to be called Mongolism.
Yeah.
And, you know, the same disorder, but two different labels. And and in the unit in which our professor taught us about Mongolism, it was still called that in those days, the whole lectures were about all the things that Mongoloid children could never learn.
Huh.
So imagine that, being taught all the things that they could never learn. So if you know you can't, they can't learn, then you wouldn't bother teaching them, right? But suppose you didn't know they couldn't learn those things, and you taught them, and maybe half of them could learn a lot of this stuff. Maybe not all could learn everything, but statistically significantly more of them could learn something if you teach more of them.
Yeah.
You know? So teaching more is one of the mechanisms that we think is at work in teaching Pygmalion effect. You teach more stuff.
Right.
And you That's teach awesome. It more warmly to the kids for whom you think there's more, you know, more favorable outcomes to come.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you. And that, and you kind of answered my question. Like, what do you think is really causing it to happen?
That's my main thought, is that those, we call that the two-factor theory. And my memory is so vague on this, but there's a former PhD student of mine named Monica Harris.
Okay.
And you could look this up. Monica Harris and I did a meta-analysis of something like, I think it was like 41 studies on the so-called mediation of these expectation effects, you know, which is like what we're talking about, you know, teaching warmly or teaching more stuff. And in this meta-analysis, we summarize the evidence, and I don't remember. Hang on one second. I have a book here.
Sure, yeah.
This is a research methods book that I wrote with my wonderful colleague, Ralph Rosno. I think together we've written about 15 books together. Ralph Rosno is a terrific guy. And in this book, we have a lot of bibliography. I want to see if I can, maybe if I have the Harris article in this, I can give you an exact reference, so you don't have to,
awesome.
You don't have to search around so much. Harris.
Hey guys, real quick before the episode continues, if you're wondering how you can supercharge your training in a way that helps you actually perform better on the mat or in the ring, I've got the perfect thing for you. I've taken the scientific concept known as transfer of learning and distilled it down into a handful of dead simple, easy to understand rules you can use to supercharge your training today. And the best part is that it almost always makes training more fun, not less. Now you don't have to spend hours and hours of drilling just to fail when your practice gets tested in sparring or competition. Instead, you can take these simple rules and transform your drills and exercises into rapid skill-building machines. Your classmates and training partners won't believe your progress. And if you're an instructor, your students will get better faster than ever and have more fun while doing it. Go to combatlearning.com/transfer to sign up to our email list and grab your transfer cheat sheet now. Plus, you'll never miss an episode and get access to exclusive tips. And just to say thanks, I'll send you my Introduction to Motor Learning for Martial Arts PDF so you can get up to speed on the powerful concepts we're discussing on this podcast. So go to combatlearning.com/transfer now to get your cheat sheet and other goodies. That's combatlearning.com/transfer, TRANSFER.
I got it.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is. It's Harris, M period, J period.
Okay.
And Rosenthal R. It's 1985. And the article is called Mediation. That's Mediation of Interpersonal Expectancy Effects.
Okay, Interpersonal Expectancy Effects.
Effect. Then there's a colon. And then it says 31. meta-analyses.
Okay. Meta-analyses.
Okay. And it's published in Psychological Bulletin.
Okay.
Volume 97. And it's pages 363 to 386.
386. Got it.
Yeah. Okay. Now, do you have access? What's your day job?
Since COVID, I used to be a search engine. I used to work with Google stuff.
Oh,
I used
no
to be a
kidding.
Search engine optimist. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. You're a computer guy.
Kind wow. of. Right now I'm a security guard because that industry got uh-huh. trashed a little bit, but I'm trying to get back in. Actually, I'd like to really make my living teaching martial arts again, but I think
I'm going to
wait until all this is blown over before I try and do that again.
And that, the reason I'm asking is I wanted to see what your best entree would be. If you were, do you know anybody in the library at Charlotte, at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte? Do you know anybody that works in the library there, in the university library?
I don't, but I have access to... My alma mater's online digital library.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Because I was going to say, nowadays, a lot of these articles are available online, free.
Yeah.
See, a lot of these articles, like this was published in Psych Bulletin, which mm-hmm. That journal is owned by the American Psychological Association, but they charge you an arm and a leg to sell you a copy.
Yeah.
But if you're going through a university library and maybe any public library that has made some kind of an agreement, for large scale, then you can get all of this stuff free online, and so you don't have to pay for any of those things. Because if you get one article, like say the Harris article mm-hmm. et al., and then that leads you from their bibliography to want to look at other articles, you should be able to get all of those articles free, but going through various libraries.
Yeah, I can do that through my school. I don't know if they have the right partnerships, but they probably do.
Okay, now here's another thing that may or may not work if you have pencil and paper handy, okay?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, Harvard University Library has a program called DASH. It's an acronym. It's all caps, DASH. And it's something like Scholastic Inquiry it's something about access to books and articles. And the way it's set up is my understanding is that books and articles that are written by people on their faculty, the Harvard faculty, mm-hmm. are available for free to anybody that writes to DASH. So you can get these articles through DASH at Harvard Library, Harvard University Library. I think that may sometimes be called Widener Library, spelled W-I-D-E-N-E-R, Widener Library.
Widener Library.
Yeah. And I know a particular person who's helping me to get more and more stuff available free, because both Ralph Rosno and I have a lot of books and articles that we want DASH to be able to give away free.
Right.
Because we don't want people making money on it. We want the scholarship to be freely available. So
awesome.
Let me give you the name of this library scholar who's in charge of this DASH program.
Okay.
His name is Colin, C-O-L-I-N.
Okay.
Lukens is his last name, L-U-K-E-N-S.
E-N-S.
L-U-K-E-N-S. And if you were to write to him, you might try without writing him first just to see how it works.
Uh-huh.
But then if you need his help and you write to him, tell him that, I gave him... I gave you his name and that I, wanted you to be able to have access to any of our articles. That would give you articles to other people, like Don Dobbin, Don Rubin's books and articles are probably freely available also, even the things he didn't write with me.
Yeah.
Because he was a Harvard professor like me too. So all the people who were Harvard professors, I don't think he's currently a professor, but like I'm a Harvard professor emeritus today. And he's a Harvard professor emeritus today, although I think he's currently teaching at Temple University.
Oh.
And although I am a Harvard emeritus professor, I'm teaching, or I will be teaching again in the fall, but only on Zoom probably.
Yeah.
I'll be teaching in the psychology department, even though I'm an emeritus professor at Harvard, but I'm on active duty at University of California, Riverside, where I'm also a professor emeritus.
Oh, so, wow.
Emeritus, but I'm still full-time, I'm regular teacher too.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Thank you. Well, that is so helpful. Thank you very much for that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you think that this affects adults really the same way that it affects the children?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And a lot of the research that's been done has been done with adults. In fact, I didn't even mention this. I didn't think of it till just now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole bunch of studies in the military.
Mm-hmm.
One of the studies I think was actually done at the Air Force Academy.
Okay.
Where they, where this was a, you know, it was an Air Force instructor, but who happened to be a psychologist also. And he, now to see, how did this work? I'm trying to think about how he did. He was in a position to assign new groups of trainees,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, to second lieutenants who would be training incoming recruits.
Okay.
And he did a basically teacher expectation manipulation where for some of these groups, now he didn't do it by individual recruits, individuals, airmen. He did it by whole classes. So in some of these classes, this was for math, teaching algebra. And I think it was in the Air Force Academy itself. So if some of these small class units were you know, put forward as having exceptional ability to learn algebra, and the others, nothing was said, they were the control group. And so all he did then was those who had been alleged to their supervisors to be better algebra learners, they actually learned algebra better than did those in the control group. So that shows it could be done with adults in the military.
Yeah.
An entirely unrelated project or series of projects was done in the Israeli army where a psychologist, an industrial psychologist, industrial / organizational psychologist named Dov, D-O-V, Eden, like the Garden of Eden, E-D-E-N.
Yeah.
He did a whole bunch of experiments also in the military, where he manipulated the trainer's expectations for the performance of military recruits. And it turned out that those military recruits, of course, who all were adults, of course, young adults usually, but still adults, if they were expected to do better in military performance, they did better in military performance. So this has been shown in different contexts. Oh, and another line of research that I just thought of was in engineering studies.
Mm-hmm.
There's some studies that show that engineers in training, if more is expected of them intellectually, they perform better intellectually.
Wow.
So it's not just a children in school phenomenon at all.
Yeah. Even the smart guys, if you expect more out of them, they perform better.
Yes, exactly. That's right. Even the smart guys, because some of these people who were being trained to be officers. So they were they were already smart guys to be in the, you know, if you're in the Air Force Academy, that's like the military academy or the Naval Academy. When you graduate, that doesn't mean you're starting out as a beginning soldier, sailor, or air person. You're you're starting out as a junior grade officer, usually second lieutenant for Army and Marine Corps, and ensign in the Navy. So yeah, I think it hits all age levels.
Yeah, that's good to know, because I know a lot of people that'll be listening to this later. They'll teach a lot of adults, and sometimes martial artists are tricky, because they'll be like, yeah, you got your research that says this, but I do this, right? And they don't understand how maybe a principle will transfer between different industries and domains of knowledge and things like that.
Yeah.
So it's really good, I think, for them to understand that it really applies everywhere.
Yeah.
It's literally in anything you can think of across all ages.
I think so, yeah.
Profound.
Yeah. And I have a hunch that if you're, you know, like, let's say you have a particular school of teaching a particular move in martial arts, and let's say there's some competing schools, my hunch is that this would work for either one of the competing things. That is, it would be my belief that it isn't the competing school of how to teach it that's making the big difference. Is that whichever school you happen to be belonging to and teaching in, those with higher expectations in either of those two schools are going to get better results than those who don't have high expectations.
Yeah, yeah. All things being equal, sure.
All things being equal, right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I know that there's definitely some techniques or some methods that you can use to help improve motor learning. But I imagine that with the like a teacher expectation effect, that you would, if you had low expectations, it wouldn't matter a whole lot. I mean, it might help some. It wouldn't matter a whole lot how good your teaching methods are, because your expectations of your students are low.
Yes, right. And it may very well be that you get some benefits from using a better teaching method. And maybe you could get some benefits from just the expectation, and maybe you get the most benefit if you have a favorable expectation and you're using the better method.
Yeah.
So maybe they add together and have an additive effect, where the method is one thing that helps improve performance, and the expectation of the teacher is an independent contributor to improved performance. So that's possible too.
Yeah, and I wonder if you have high expectations of students, and you have that warmth that you talked about, and you teach more like you talked about, if you don't accidentally start to organize your trainings in a way where you start to use better methods without realizing it, right? So like spaced repetition.
Well, if you look, teach, write that down. I'm serious. Write that down, what you just said. Because that's a very original idea of yours.
You think so?
Oh, yes. I've never heard anybody say that.
Yeah. One of the reasons I say that is because it's spaced repetition. Yeah. If you teach more, then you have more instances to come around. You have space between what you're learning, and you come back around.
This is a whole new idea to me.
Well, I'm glad
that the expectation is affecting the method.
Yeah,
you know, as well as general attitude.
It
actually shapes the way you teach. Yes,
yeah, I wonder.
No, absolutely. Keep that as a specific hypothesis within more general hypotheses. You know, so that you could do, so when you do studies, you could design your studies in such a way that you can examine this very special and very original idea of yours at the same time that you're looking at the more general idea. And that way you get more bang for your research buck.
Because
you're thinking beforehand about the different research questions, and you're able to build them all into the same study, which makes it a more economical enterprise to do your research.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, I'm getting my bang for my buck with this interview, because you're telling me all kinds of good advice.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, that makes me really excited, because this is just stuff I don't have a lot of people to talk to about this stuff, because not a lot of martial artists are into this kind of stuff.
Yeah, so right.
I'm asking, there's what so far my podcast is really resonating with people because there's not this kind of content around. So I think there's a need for it out there, but people just don't have the language and the knowledge to talk about it yet. So that's kind of where I'm trying to fill in the gap. So we can actually improve, you know, how we go about teaching in the martial arts industry.
That's right. And there's a catch term nowadays that's used in medical research and educational research. It's called evidence-based teaching and evidence-based medicine, which means you can actually point to the research data. For example, in the case of medications, it would usually be randomized clinical trials using a placebo control. You know, that would be like the gold standard in medical research.
Right.
And that kind of research would be called evidence-based. Whereas if you did a randomized experiment in medicine where half of them got the new medication and the other half, the control group, didn't get it, that wouldn't be publishable in a good journal because everybody knows about the placebo effect. So to get it published in a good medical journal, you can't just have a no treatment control group. You have to have a group that is a placebo control that believes they are getting, or at least believes that they may be getting. And that's the way the ethical placebo medical studies, you know, everybody's recruited into these medical studies, and they're told half of you are going to get the placebo, and then half of you are going to get the real thing. And then they randomly, assign the patients to the medical treatment. And even the doctors don't know who's who till the experiment is all done. And then they unblind, you know, and find out who is in which group. Because they know that the expectation of the doctors or the nurses giving the medication, that alone can make the difference.
Yeah.
You know, so if the attitude of the nurse or the doctor giving the medication is more positive, that may make the patient better.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's with the evidence based. I remember coming across that in my studies, my graduate studies.
Oh, you heard that term then? Oh, great.
Yeah. Especially because there's a big issue in educational psychology with a disparity between the research and then teachers actually being able to read and apply it. And it's just, I think teachers kind of, it's the same for martial artists too. We're really bad about this. We really just teach the way we were taught, and we don't really look at like what's the research kind of saying. Is there bad assumptions that we make about how we teach, or are we being skeptical about the methods that we employ? Are we really being honest about the results? You know, are we making some sort of attribution error somewhere?
Yeah.
And that's just, a lot of times I understand that I didn't end up teaching like in the school system, but I understand that a lot of teachers in the school system, they have kind of they already have kind of a notion of how to teach when they go through school, and they don't pay a lot of attention to how the research could actually help them, right? And how they could apply it. So there's a big, I don't remember what there's a name for it that the actual issue is, but there's definitely a disparity there between, you know, practice and the actual research. But my mom is an occupational therapist.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And her and I, when I taught martial arts, I had, and I don't know why this is the case. It could just be my personality, but I had a very high number of special needs students in my program. And so I was coming into, this is really how I got into motor learning, honestly. And I was really doing a lot of research on how I could help these kids in my classes, because I didn't want to, like you mentioned tracking before, I didn't want to track them into a separate class. I wanted to integrate them in with all of the kids.
Right.
And I was able to do it for the most part.
Wonderful. Yeah.
But because of those experiences, my mom and I, because my mom does occupational therapy, she works with a lot of kids that have different sensory and movement disorders. We'll bounce ideas off each other. I've given her ideas for different interventions and therapies before that she's really liked. And she really, that's all she talks about is the evidence-based practice. That's her.
Oh, that's great.
That's her thing.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So she's going in for her master's degree.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. Very excited. She's taking kinesiology, which I never got a chance to take in college. So what she knows that I like that. So I'll be keeping up with her on that so that I can also learn some kinesiology.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's great.
Yeah. I'm a little bit of a nerd, but
that's so cool.
but yeah, that's, I love that term. I wanna move. And I know there's a lot of coaches out there, especially some of my close friends, that really want to move towards an evidence-based practice in the martial arts realm.
Yeah.
You know, especially in sports with, you know, we got the Olympics coming up in Taekwondo. Taekwondo is really my main combat sport, really? Martial arts. So I really want to improve how we find and develop our talent for Olympics and international competition. I think there's a lot of room for improvement on that front.
Yeah. Gee. Terrific. Well, you're in such a great position to be cutting edge leader in, you know, in bringing evidence-based practice to your profession. I think that's wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah. I did have a question I wrote down earlier.
Sure.
If we could circle back to tracking, because that's kind of something I've thought about too.
Absolutely.
How do you feel about tracking? I know that you what you said was a little bit different, I think. My understanding of tracking was taking out exceptional students from regular classroom and putting them into an exceptional program instead of trying to integrate them. I was wondering how you felt about that.
Well, that's not the way tracking works. The way tracking works is more like, what it usually comes down to is very early reading skills.
So
tracking usually starts like in the first grade if they've been to kindergarten, or the second grade. And the reason that I'm saying it's not like special ed kids, and the reason is that I say that is that the fast, the medium, and the slow tracks in the schools that have all three tracks, those are almost equal sized classes. Mm-hmm. And the special need kids are not usually 33% of the kids.
Okay.
You know, that's a much smaller percentage. And so it's usually reading ability that leads the early classification. And one of the things that I've heard educators who don't like tracking, and I have not done any research myself on tracking. So I have no personal evidence-based information about tracking. But the theory that I've heard espoused is that the slow track suffers for the rest of their school career from having relatively low expectations. Uh-huh. Even if it's true that they may have started out as slow reading, they could have been fast math. They could have been near the top of their class.
Right.
But because they don't have specialized teachers in the early grades, they just have the one teacher with the one expectation. Huh. And so that same teacher who's teaching the reading or the social studies is teaching the math, although she or he may not even be that comfortable teaching math.
Yeah.
But their expectations there may be even especially powerful. And so I've heard a lot of strong arguments against tracking, but I really have no evidence-based basis I don't even have an opinion about it.
Uh-huh.
Because the research that we did was really done separately within the fast, the medium, and the slow track. So we know it applies at all three levels.
Right.
But we don't, you know, we don't have, I have no direct evidence that tracking per se helps or hurts. I don't know that literature.
Yeah.
So if if you were going to do a doctoral dissertation, let's say on that question, I'd be glad to, you know, read over drafts of that too, even though I have no research experience on that particular question.
Yeah.
But it may very well be that there's a literature that you could find through your article finding skills, you know, because you're good on computer stuff. So you could maybe find all kinds of articles, unpublished doctoral dissertations,
yeah,
or master's theses, convention reports, plus published stuff that you could get through Harvard's DASH or through a local university library or even a public library, or somehow get your hands on and then sort of synthesize that for a doctoral dissertation on does tracking work?
Yeah.
Now, you know, I don't know. Somebody may already have done that somewhere. I don't know.
I'm not familiar with the literature on it. What I remember from school was it was a kind of a survey over different things. It was an ed psych class. So it was kind of going over the different issues in the field. And what I remember it saying is that what they found in the studies that were in the textbook, what they found was kids that are moved into a track of like a slower or in any way a lesser ability than another, that they actually, they suffered a lot more than if they were integrated, wherein really even the exceptional kids that are better didn't suffer either. Like everyone kind of did better in a untracked environment. That's what I remember.
So in other words, from that perspective, if you had, let's say you had 90 kids in the first grade, and one teacher could handle 30 max, then instead of dividing them into the high, medium, and low thirds in terms of their reading ability, this would argue that you should almost just randomly assign them to the three groups just to keep the class sizes small.
Yeah.
You don't want one teacher teaching 90 kids, you know.
Yeah.
But that the kids would all do better on average. Even the average kids would do better. And maybe even the bright kids would do better.
Yeah, they do. Know, and I think one of the
class.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I think some of it's starting to come back now that I'm thinking about it was what they found was in classes where they're all integrated and they, so you have to have the two methods going together. They're all integrated. And then, and where they used a method of peer-to-peer exercises, some of the more abled readers could work with the less abled readers, and it was actually really great for both of them. So I think that's why.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds great, because you're doing something special for both groups.
Yeah, and you know, when you teach something, it gives you another perspective on it, right? It kind of makes you better at it in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. I have to go back and look at that again, because it's been a while since I've read it.
Yeah, but there's another doctoral dissertation for you. did you do your undergraduate work at Charlotte?
No, I did both of my, so I worked through college, so I did it online at Liberty University. So I didn't really get a chance to do a lot of that kind of research, but I would like to do a PhD. So, I mean, that would be, yeah.
Yeah. And you could do it in, Charlotte offers a PhD, I bet, don't they?
Oh, yeah, in like education definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, education or ed psych sound like those would be the right homes for this kind of research that we're talking about. But I mean, you're exactly the kind of a person that we should have out there teaching the teachers. I mean, you should be the professor in the ed school teaching, you know, the teachers of the future, all this kind of stuff.
Well, thank you, man. So, coming from you, that's incredible. Thank you. Yeah. Man, you're making me feel like $1 million. You're making me really confident right now.
Well, that's great. But, you know, follow up on it. Do all this looking and see what you can bring to the discipline. I mean, you've got a lot to offer here. Both in terms of questions that have been around a long time, like does tracking work?
It's
obvious to me you've done more thinking about that than most faculty members in ed schools have thought about. So, you know, you got a head start right there.
Yeah.
And plus the very specific kinds of hypotheses that you had about expectation effect. Mm-hmm. Expectation can actually affect the teaching method, which is a wholly new idea. It's a wholly new idea that you just came up with.
Wow.
So, you know, there's all kinds of dissertations available to you.
Oh man. Which one to choose? Well, I'm really interested in motivational psychology too, and how that for training and
Well, there you go.
So it's like, I think my problem is I have too many, I'm interested in too many things. That's probably my problem.
Now here's a very practical educational tip for you.
Yeah.
To help you decide whether you want to get your PhD in education or psychology.
Uh-huh.
Look carefully at the requirements for the PhD in both programs, because if you go through education, chances are you will know every kind of course that they're going to require. If you went through psychology, you might have to take a lot of stuff you're not that interested in. For example, you might have a lot of stuff on, I can't think of the name at the moment, but a lot of psych departments are now changing their names from psychology to psychology, and it's a biological, a neuroscience.
Oh, okay.
You've heard the term neuroscience, right?
Yeah.
Cognitive neuroscience and just plain neuroscience, and like schools like Duke University, which I know you know about.
Duke
University, I think, now changed their title from a Department of Psychology a few years ago to now I think they are a Department of Psychology and Neuroscience. And I think a lot of the psych departments did that because they thought somehow neuroscience sounded more scientific, you know? And so I think they did it to get the imprimatur of more scientific. But you should look carefully, because you might have to take a lot of classes that you might not want to take. On the other hand, you might see a lot of classes that you'd have to take in one of those that you didn't know, but that you'd love to take. So that should help you argue. That what I'm suggesting basically is examine carefully the pre-PhD courses that you'd have to take either for either PhD.
Mm-hmm.
So like in my PhD program at UCLA many, many years ago, my PhD was 1956. So that's like 64 years ago. But you had to have a particular type of undergraduate course in psychology in order to get into a PhD program in psychology. And some PhD programs in psychology might still have that. So you want to check carefully for a particular program you're interested in going to. Look and see what the prerequisites are that you don't immediately know you want to take. Because there'll be a lot of courses that you know you want to take in psychology or education. Mm-hmm. But there may be others you're not that crazy to take that may be different, and that may throw the dice in the direction of which one you opt for. It's whichever one offers you the most advanced undergraduate or beginning graduate level courses that you want to have under your belt before you get your PhD.
Oh, that's great advice. I'll definitely keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I actually got to run, but I could talk to you all day. I think.
Well, we can talk again if you want to talk again sometime. We'll just set up another time by email.
Yeah,
and we can, you know, late afternoons is always good for me. And you know, if you have a really quick question, just send an email. I'll answer it real quick. But if it's a conversation type thing, then I love to talk to you. You've got such great ideas. and we need you in the teaching cadre of educational psychology and education both, so we need you.
Well, thank you. I will definitely take you up on that. I would love to do this again and pick your brain on all things related to the Pygmalion effect and
wonderful.
Any of your other experiences you've had in research. But
great.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming on, and I'll
I'm happy
talk to you later.
Okay, take good care. Bye-bye now.
Thanks so much for listening to the Combat Learning Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. It really helps us out. Finally, this episode, including the intro music, is produced by Micah Peacock. Thanks in advance, and I'll see you on the next episode. We'll be right back.